Hello and welcome to On a Tangent, the podcast where the main characters are the stories behind the mathematics. My name is Simone, and in each episode I meet a different early career researcher from Münster to learn about their paths towards mathematics and their hopes for the future. In this episode, I interview Edith, a PhD student in topology, to learn about her journey from physics to mathematics and what the future holds for infinity categories. I hope you enjoy the episode. All right, hi, welcome on the podcast. It's a pleasure to have you. So, as you know, in each episode we sort of explore the stories that mathematicians have gone through here in Münster. So we always start in the past. So what is your earliest memory of mathematics? What's the first time you think maths has entered your life?
Yes. So at first, thanks for inviting me. It's an actually kind of funny question because in essence, I don't really remember a particular event that marks my beginning interest in mathematics. It's more like being exposed to it constantly, roughly, I would say. So what I do remember is that as a child, and I guess that must have been during primary school, I entertained myself with mathematical puzzle books, but definitely they were about calculating some stuff. And there were also some computer games. One is based on a Swedish story of it's called Patson and Findus. Maybe you've heard of this. Mm. It's an old guy with a cat, and they are living in a farmhouse in Sweden and having various adventures. And there are computer games based on this. And and in one of these games, so there were little gnomes which are also living in the farmhouse, and they were wearing bike helmets and
because they go biking.
Or? No, they're not going biking. They were running. And
I see, safety first somehow.
Safety first. Actually, the point is, at least the idea in the computer game was that there were different gnomes and each running distances of different lengths at different speeds. And their most important wish was to collide in the middle.
I see. So that's why they were wearing helmets.
That was why they were wearing helmets. Yes, of course. And now your task as the person who's playing the game was to calculate the appropriate starting times for each of the gnomes so that they would actually collide and not miss each other. So I had definitely lots of fun with this.
I feel like this is a dangerous game to give to a child. you're teaching the child, if you want to bang heads with your friends, at least compute correctly the trajectories,
You should compute. Yes, definitely. Well, I mean, I think there was no one really hurt.
That's good. That's good.
You should still remember it was a children's game.
No, I'm good. I don't know. There was a spike of incidents of children banging heads with each other after the game came out because they all learned maths very well, but they also then sort of learned how to.
Yeah, probably. I don't know. I never tried that in real life, I have to admit.
I see.
So this is another instance. And maybe actually the most kind of abstract math instance was my mother showing me some identities for binomial coefficients. I must have been 15, mm-hmm. something like okay. this. And I have to say, I did appreciate that she took the time to do this, but somehow I was not too enthusiastic about it. Because the point was, during my entire period at school, I never really encountered mathematics as it is taught at university and as mm-hmm. My main interest was actually in physics.
Yeah, somehow I feel like this is a very common phenomenon where you really don't see. It's hard to get enthusiastic about maths when you're in school because the maths that you're taught in school is top 10 best rules to compute this integral, and you're but surely there is a more fun way to do maths, right? Nothing against integrals, of course, but
no, nothing against integrals. No, yeah, it was more like I kind of appreciated mathematics as a tool to compute stuff in other natural sciences, like for example, physics. And I mean, it was never really a big issue. I didn't really kind of consider it as a subject in its own right because I was never really told what the essence of mathematics is.
Yeah, you're taught maths as a tool, exactly as you said.
So, and then of course, I guess physics is much more kind of accessible to the general public due to astronomy and the nice pictures.
And nuclear physics and all, of course,
Yes, so I think, and then also, of course, there is spotting the ISS in the night sky, something that you can directly experience.
Yes.
I think that has a much bigger kind of fascination.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And when you went into physics, were you sure which kind of physics you wanted to do, like more experimental, more theoretical?
Well, I guess more on the theoretical side, but I do belong to this group of people who are very enthusiastic about astrophysics.
I see.
And say I want to learn about the universe. How did the universe come into existence? Where does everything go to? These big, more even philosophical questions.
Yeah.
And in the end, I have to admit, I never really took an astrophysics lecture.
But maybe that would ruin the magic a bit, no?
Maybe, I don't know.
I remember I pondered doing astronomy. So there was in Italy, there's a bachelor's degree in astronomy somewhere, I forgot where.
Yes.
And I wanted to apply, and then I sort of looked at the courses, and there was a lot of statistics and data, and I'm like, actually, maybe that's not what I want to do. And I feel like it might ruin the magic a bit because you do get, in the end, you're looking at the data from, I don't know, these or that satellite, yes, which is, of course, incredible that you can get this data. But
it is incredible. I mean, what I did after school, immediately after school, I did an internship at the Max Planck Institute for Astrophysics in Munich. And I was also the task I was given because, I had just graduated from school, so I was not really helpful in any sense, but I should kind of transcribe some program that was written in programming language, I guess it was R.
I see, okay.
Into the newer language, it's called Root, it's based on C++.
Mm-hmm.
And that was, and the intention was, of course, to use this program to analyze, data from some satellite that they launched 10 years ago and that was still lying around. And it was kind of so it's exactly that, what you were talking about. So kind of programming in order to analyze data that you collect. And I also learned that, most of these projects are kind of designed for a scientific lifetime of one person, because you have to build the entire equipment yourself or have engineers build it for you and then just launch it into some orbit, collect the data, bring it back to Earth. That takes a long time.
Yeah.
So it's one big project, and if that kind of fails, then it's not great.
Of course, yeah. And somehow, I remember I did something similar in high school, and somehow they gave us this data. I don't remember what it was, probably the light of a certain star fluctuating over time. And of course, it was fantastic and brilliant that we had this data, but somehow it took away the magic of astrophysics. I was okay, it's a lot of number crunching, which is great, but somehow it depends on what the taste that brought you into that direction is, right?
Yes.
So you said you always had the taste for the theoretical, so somehow is that what brought you towards mathematics at the end?
Not directly. So
okay.
When I started studying physics, and I was pretty sure I wanted to do physics, I never really gave mathematics a serious thought as a subject of study. But then I was kind of confronted with mathematics during a linear algebra lecture,
right,
that we all had to take. And that was kind of horrible for me because it was actually, we did lots of stuff. So, and especially working with the axiom of choice in order to prove that an arbitrary vector space has a basis, infinite dimensional vector spaces. and like showing that every subjective Mao has a right to join, something like this. That was the first exercise on the first exercise sheet.
That seems a bit.
That was a bit crazy.
Brutal.
It was brutal. It was definitely brutal, and I definitely did not enjoy it because it was like it left me in some kind of state of shock. Mm-hmm. but I, yeah, and I did not enjoy this, but I kind of had enough, like, let's say, perseverance in order to say, well, I don't want to let this stop me.
Mm-hmm.
So I kind of finished that lecture and passed the exam. And then, well, I mean, the lecture itself definitely did not spark my interest in mathematics. But I kind of was eager enough to sit down with a book, like, I think, general, like, calculus book, and read through it myself, because I had the feeling that during that lecture there was like too much input in too short a time.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, well, I do want to go over all of this again in my own speed and have a look at this and see whether I like it or not. And when I was doing it by myself, that was much more fun.
Of course, yeah.
And I started understanding things, which was also great.
Mm-hmm.
And then I had a calculus course by some, like, calculus for physicists. That was taught by a mathematics professor, and the point was that, I mean, he provided lecture notes like beforehand, and I mean the lecture itself was not great because okay. I think in general mathematicians don't like teaching courses for non-mathematicians.
Yeah, in my former university we used to call them like service courses. Like if you like, everybody had to like pay this price of getting at least one service course per year, and you could be okay-ish. I think the physicist ones were actually the ones that people were okay with. Yes. But it could be worse. You could have like calculus biology. For biotechnologies.
Yes,
you know?
I know. That's even worse.
I mean not to say, but like I feel like in the hierarchy of which courses people do not want to teach, like statistics for biology is like top 10 things people are like,
I totally agree.
Not sure I want to teach this.
I totally agree. But this professor also, I think, did not want to teach the physicists. And the physicists mm-hmm. also did not want to be taught this kind of
I see.
So it was a mutual relationship. And I mean, I think what he did was just kind of using his lecture notes and projecting them on the wall and using some text marker to write into, like, to write on the notes. Mm-hmm. And this being his lecture. And of course, like, people
not
really
great,
hated it. But because I was reading the lecture notes by myself, I had been reading them beforehand. And I was just trying to kind of like really understand each detail in the proof. And at some point, I was convinced that a proof was like already finished at some point, and that the other things that were like written later in the script were not needed. And I kind of mustered the courage to tell the professor during the lecture.
Mm-hmm.
And that was also kind of a shocking experience because nobody normally talked during the lecture.
Right, everybody just sort of sat through the pain and were like, okay, it's over, thank you.
Yes, so. And then somebody telling you, oh, I think your proof is already done. You mm-hmm. don't need to do more. And that kind of like, led me being kind of enthralled by it.
Mm-hmm.
Because, I mean, at the point I was, I mean, he came and looked at me and said, are you very sure about this? And I was very much intimidated. But also, like, I mean, it kind of sparked some enthusiasm
mm-hmm.
in myself. And also the professor, like, he became more enthusiastic himself by I kind of noticing that there's a student who's interested in what he's got to say.
Or at least who's paying attention. You know?
At least he's paying attention as well, yes. So, like, I think it was kind of this professor who got me into mathematics. Because I also felt I wanted to show him that physicists can understand pure math.
Mm-hmm.
So I was, yeah.
Lo and behold, a few years later.
Yes.
my crossed that bridge.
Yeah. Yeah, so I think, yeah, that was really kind of the event that let me, like, consider, like, mathematics as the thing I wanted to do. I think that the more I learned about mathematics, the more difficult it became for me to understand physics lectures, because mm-hmm. I really wanted to know about the precise mathematical requirements that they were like asking for in their theories.
And then, which, yeah, they're famously a bit sloppy somehow, yeah.
Yes, yes. And then it became very frustrating, and that led me to say, like, led me to the decision to do math rigorously. Mm-hmm. Because I felt like, I mean, I had that feeling that only a very few people manage to be both a physicist and a mathematician. It seemed to me like the way of thinking about mathematics was kind of fundamentally different between these mm-hmm. two groups of people.
And would you say even for like very theoretical physicists? Because somehow, sometimes you read these sort of inflammatory claims, which are like, well, you know, a string theorist fundamentally is just a mathematician.
Yes, I know. I mean, I have to say, I mean, I don't know any string theorists personally. So, I cannot answer on that. But still, I think that physicists have a different approach to mathematics. Like, also like more... like regarding it as a tool and being more willing to do like things that are obviously forbidden by mm-hmm. by mathematical, I mean, things that are like forbidden operations in a mathematical sense, just to try out and see what kind of like mm-hmm. results they would get
in a calculation. Some insight somehow.
Yes, and this is, I mean, oh, and I think, of course, like maybe that would actually help mathematicians to be a bit faster, mm-hmm. like doing stuff. But yeah, at least I had this, yeah, and also like, I don't know whether a theoretical physicist would say that he or she appreciates mathematics for the sake of itself, like mm-hmm. without any, yes, yes,
it's not art for the sake of, I mean, or it's not for the sake of mathematics, right? It's a means to an end, of course, for the physicist, whereas for the mathematicians it's somehow very different. Yeah,
yes.
And so this is your story somehow up to maths, and so what brought you to what you do nowadays and what it is that you do nowadays?
Yes, yeah, so during the course of my bachelor studies, and especially in my bachelor thesis, I started like learning about category theory. Mm-hmm. I became very interested in that, and then I learned that there was something called infinity category theory.
I see.
And
is this in your bachelor's?
Yeah, that was in my bachelor's, yes.
Was it your bachelor thesis supervisor a physicist?
It was a joint supervision,
right?
Okay. And one of them was a theoretical physicist, the other one was a mathematician. Mm-hmm. But in the end, like, the topic was provided by the mathematician,
right?
And the physicist agreed for me to work on it and said, "Well, do as you please." Like,
kind of, you can do infinity categories. It's okay.
I am very, very grateful and indebted to him that he allowed me to do this. I have to say, because there is no immediate connection to physics.
I see, okay.
Yes, but so I started like becoming interested in this. I mean, I did not learn about infinity categories during my bachelor's, but I decided to go like to university for my master's, where there is a professor working mm-hmm. in infinity category theory. And I first went to Regensburg and then learned about Thomas Nikolaus being in Münster and decided, okay, I will try this. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of how I ended up working in homotopy theory and infinity categories.
Right, so that's what you do nowadays?
Yes, so I mean, I am, well, currently working on a joint project with Thomas on a question that is... Well, we're trying to assess whether there exists a theory of something that you might call non-additive stabilization for infinity one categories. This is a question intrinsic to infinity one category theory, which is motivated by some examples.
Okay.
And I might tell you about some examples.
Perhaps that's I feel like occasionally, I don't want to say they're a bit taboo, but I feel like occasionally when infinity categories are mentioned, people have a moment of like, okay, oof. Yes, I'm ready, but like, give me a moment.
I agree that infinity categories are scary at first sight. And maybe they're also scary at a second glance. I think this is mainly due to our unfamiliarity with their inherent concept, namely to specify relations between mathematical objects or mathematical operations only up to coherent homotopy, as opposed to, for example, isomorphism. And doing this involves remembering a lot of data, and then of course it has to be made precise, so there's rather heavy machinery underlying the theory of infinity categories, which you have to become familiar with in order to work with them. But I should also say that the theory itself, at least the model that is current, that is most used, which was developed by Joyal and especially Lurie, is a very elegant model. Let me give you an example of an unfamiliar feature of infinity categories. If you think of an ordinary category, then whenever you are given a pair of morphisms with matching source and target, there is a unique composite map. This is essentially by definition. In an infinity category, the composite still exists, or a composite still exists, but it's no longer unique. So in general, there will be several different composites. And the uniqueness statement translates into the statement that the space of all composites is contractible.
You've talked about this project. What is one question or one problem you would like to see solved in the next 10 years? Of course, it could be the project you just talked about, but of course, or you could allow yourself to be a bit more, be as ambitious as you wish, yeah? I've said before, it could be a problem that you have some sort of emotional connection with, some question that you're really annoyed that there's no answer to,
My wish for the future. That is a very difficult question. So, I think I should say that homotopy theory is a quite young and rapidly evolving field of research. So there are lots of things to be uncovered and also lots of things being uncovered. And so there is lots of progress, I think. I think one of the big goals to achieve is to reach a better understanding of the basic objects, namely the infinity category of spectra. So that's certainly very important. And of course there is also lots of knowledge that is out there and which hasn't been written up, so it would be great to see a collective effort of everyone researching in the field to write this up, to write up their knowledge and make it accessible. But I think that's a general thing. Like, it always takes much longer than you expect, and this is nothing really specific to homotopy theory. My personal goal, I would say that is kind of to find out what interests me the most. So there are lots of different subfields within homotopy theory. For example, there is equivariant homotopy theory, there's chromatic homotopy theory. There are people working on infinity N categories, or like in high algebraic K-theory and dualizable categories. And I don't really know what is the place where I would like to be. So I think that's really, really the biggest personal goal. the most selfish wish that I can tell you about is that at some point I would like to see Lambda Rings in action. Lambda Rings are algebraic objects which appear, for example, in K-theory. And one precise question that you can ask is whether they can be harnessed in a way resembling the use of delta rings and prismatic cohomology to define integral cohomology theories. And I really don't know whether this will be answered in the near future or not. And actually, like, if there will be no answer, then it's also not too bad. Because there are so many interesting things that I don't think I'll get bored anyways.
Well, thank you very much for the very nice insights.
Thank you very much.